I think we should be very careful about artificial intelligence. If I were to guess at what our biggest existential threat is,
it's second probably is a revolutionary moment.
Hey, how does it land?
Bill,
what the breaches in the rocket cylinder drove its mill. I can give you no authoritative information either to their nature, their origin, or their purposes here on Earth.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this exciting edition of Creative Futurism. I'm John Best.
And I'm Kevin J. Anderson. Welcome to the podcast.
And we are here to talk about the future and be creative about it. Right, Kevin?
And to be businesslike about it, because everything's going to be all tangled together in the future, because everybody has to know their business, has to know how to be creative and how to survive. And maybe we can help you out with that.
Absolutely. Well, let's get right into it, man. You've been on the road. You know, we haven't had a lot of chance to catch up. And I know that you had something exciting happen because I finally got mine in the mail, which was awesome. So talk a little bit. Tell me what's going on.
Sure. Well, I travel a lot because I've always got this constant stream of new projects and new books coming out. A couple of weeks ago, I was guest at the Planet Comic Con in Kansas City. So I signed a lot of autographs and met a lot of people there. And I just late last night came home from Emerald City Comic Con, which is a huge event in Seattle, which is, I think their numbers are like 110,000 people or so attendees, just filling up the Seattle Convention Center. And the exciting thing that we had there is I have a brand new graphic novel with my co-author, Stephen Sears, who is a veteran TV writer, producer. You might have seen a TV show that he did called Xena Warrior Princess for many years.
I remember that one.
Yeah, and he and I collaborated on this really cool book called Stalag X, which is sort of a human POWs in an alien concentration camp in a war of genocide in the far future. So it's almost like the Bridge on the River Kwai or Stalag 17, only it's got like big nasty aliens and it's on an alien planet. And so that just debuted. It's up for pre-order on Amazon. It'll come out in June. But we had pre-release copies there, so we were autographing, met a whole bunch of other creators and fans. And just this afternoon, we announced the fact that we have entered a partnership with Shoreline Entertainment to develop it as a film or TV.
Wow.
And we've got the pilot script all written. So all kinds of things. Like I mentioned at the beginning to the podcast, that you can't just be a writer anymore and expect it to happen. Or you can't just be a comic scripter, or you can't just be an actor. It's like you've got to be a one-man band and take care of all of it. So that's what we're doing. And at these comic cons, they're filled with just exuberant fans and aspiring writers and cosplayers who dress in their favorite superhero costumes, as well as the actors who are in a lot of the superhero TV shows. We've kind of got superheroes on our mind, which is what leads us into our guest today. John, you want to introduce him?
Certainly. Yeah, I definitely have superheroes on my mind. I saw Black Panther over the weekend, which was amazing. And so we had a person reach out to us and say, hey, I think I'd be a good fit for your podcast. And he sent me some information. And apparently this is all about sort of becoming superhuman in a way and having powers. And so the gentleman's name is Ira Pastor, and he is the CEO of BioQuark. Welcome, Ira. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me today. It's a great pleasure.
When I looked at your site, I was struck by some of the information in there. I mean, some of the claims are just amazing. Before we get going, why don't you just give a little background on yourself and BioQuark and what you've been doing?
Yeah, so BioQuark is a life sciences company focused on what we call in-house the three R's. So regeneration, reversion of disease or the disease state, and rejuvenation, with the ultimate goal of applying these tools, or basically these what we'll call these superhuman abilities that we typically see with many other organisms that inhabit this planet with us, and how we can sort of reawaken them for the purposes of human health, wellness, and disease prevention and reversal. As many people are quite aware, there are many species on this planet. The amphibians come to mind, of course, that are capable of replacing lost or damaged organs, tissues, and limbs that are identical in both structure and function to the original ones throughout their lifetime. Mm-hmm. Now, this goes for severed spinal cords, arms and legs, heart, eyeballs, even large parts of the brain. What is a little less well known is there are many species in the regenerative kingdom that also have amazing skills for reversing genetic and cellular damage when it occurs. So, I point out, everything on this planet gets cancer at some point, but there's many species that shrug cancer off as if it was, the common cold, and don't, like humans, don't, die from it 8 million a year. And lastly, of course, you have the long end of the spectrum, which you have some organisms that do not age at all. You have the ones that age in reverse, and then even have some that technically die and are reborn. Needless to say, when it comes to humans, we do not possess these skills today.
You're sounding just like a Spider-Man supervillain, the lizard. That was, wasn't it, Dr. Mike Rogers or something, I think his name was. No, I forget what his name was.
He was trying to regrow his arm, wasn't he?
Yeah, he had lost an arm, and he was studying the lizard ability to regrow tails, so he was trying to regrow his arm, and of course, then he turned into the villain, the lizard. See, the stuff you're talking about, Ira, is truly the stuff of science fiction, and we've everything you said is just ringing all my bells about how really cool that would be. And now the stuff that you're talking about is just innate to the genetics of that organism. And are you talking about hoping to use or learn from this to do genetic modifications or physical mechanical modifications like artificial arms and things? What's the scope or the basics of how you're approaching this?
Great question. And so, so what the lizard did wrong in the Spider-Man comics was try to genetically engineer sort of the lizard into the human. We're not doing any of that. We're not doing any chimera production. The path that we're taking on this is basically looking at the sort of the one part of the Human Genome Project that doesn't get talked about a lot. When it comes to humans, and then every other species out there, for the most part, we all have the same genes. We have the evolutionary past of a lot of the stuff that came before us. On top of that, what you do when you study sort of the genes that are involved in salamander tail regeneration, you find out, unfortunately, that a lot of them have to do with cancer formation and early growth. So you don't want uncontrollable genetic engineering and growth, because that's going to lead you in the wrong direction. The position that we're taking is, if we can create drug-like substances, biologics that can modulate the genes, turn them on and off at will in a controlled fashion, that can sort of mimic the epimorphic regeneration of the limb or the heart or the brain, we can avoid both the problems associated with genetic engineering and, of course, the costs. So, to see some of these gene therapies nowadays, $1 million, $2 million a pop. So we want to stay away from all of that and use more of what nature is teaching us in regard to how the salamander, how the planarian, how the starfish undertakes these changes, and then look at the proxies that we have still as humans and how we slowly, in a controlled fashion, either increase or decrease the expression of certain genes, but not in a permanent fashion. We don't want to end up like the lizard. We want to be more like Wolverine.
So what specific technology jumps have happened that have made this suddenly something that's within the realm of you completing? Is it stem cells? Is it, supercomputing? What's opened this door up?
It really has to do with quite a bit of those technologies combined with what we'll call comparative genomics, so the ability to compare the genome of a human and a salamander and see what's going on and what the differences are. And at the same time, regeneration, as an example, is something that we've studied for hundreds of years now from a phenomenological perspective. The heyday of regenerative biology in the 20th century was, say, from the 1940s to the 1970s. We've studied these organisms a long amount of time. What has changed a bit is our sort of understanding of the complexity, the biological moieties that are involved in complex regeneration, and moving away from sort of the traditional pharmaceutical industry's perspective that, everything needs to be a so-called single magic bullet, a little white pill that you get at your local Rite Aid. The complexity of the therapeutics and what a drug actually can be in the 21st century is going to look a lot different than what it was in the 20th century. So the ability to, for instance, develop drugs that maybe are mixtures of therapeutic substances that can undertake this type of complete regeneration, as opposed to, say, a single synthetic substance that only does one thing, is an example of how not only has technology changed, but also regulatory bodies that approve these types of things are willing to look at. So it's both been a technological as well as a sort of a regulatory shift that's finally allowing us to move down this path.
Well, one of the things that comes to mind is the things that you're talking about is basically almost like a fountain of youth or a fountain of health, that it would help us maintain our bodies in the optimum condition. But what about some funkier stuff, like some more designer human bodies that you take some sort of modification that will allow you to withstand greater colds? You can live up on Mount Everest if you want to, or live under the water in a more amphibious fashion, to basically changing you into a different species of human. That, of course, I'm the science fiction guy, so I was thinking of The Shape of Water, which just won all the Academy Awards. And there are ways now, I think, in the future, that we could just adapt our bodies to all sorts of different designer forms.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's quite a few out. I mean, you point to an excellent one. And, you know, when coming back to the theme of sort of the hidden genome or the evolutionary past, remember, you, I, everyone listening to this right now, we all possessed webbed feet, webbed hands, gills, a tail when we were inside our mothers. Uh-huh. So that genomics is not forgotten. It's there. It's a matter of reawakening it. So, you know, that's an excellent example. A couple of the ones that, you know, we talk about quite a bit would be radiation resistance. Looking at a lot of these organisms that, you know, swim around in radioactive waste and, you know, have their genomes destroyed, but, you know, rebuild them in an instant, like Deinococcus radiodurans, which is, you know, one of the most indestructible organisms on this planet. The tardigrades, of course, which can resist the vacuum of outer space.
Those are the sea pigs, right? That's what the tardigrade is? Is that what they call it?
Water bears.
Oh, yeah. Water bears. Sorry, I was close.
And then another really interesting one, and they've been doing a lot of work on this actually here in Philly, is the whole area of cryptobiosis. So basically how one can design human hibernation skills for, you know, trips to Mars and beyond, and, you know, basically how the bear and the squirrel and all these other organisms that can go to sleep for 6 months do it, and how we can sort of realize some of this.
How about night vision? I wonder, that's something that I've been wanting for a long time.
I mean, yeah, so you have plenty of organisms that can see in infrared and ultraviolet and many different spectrums of light. Magnetonavigation and magneto reception is a really cool one.
Wait, did you just say I could have powers like Magneto? Because that would be the best.
We have in our eyes. I mean, you know, birds, you know, that's how a bird can fly 2,000 miles and know where it's going each and every
time. I want to be able to control all the metal around me and, like, move bridges and stuff like Magneto.
Well, we'd probably have to think a little bit more.
Okay. Wow.
Well, and I wouldn't want too terribly many people to have something like that. Can you, I mean, right now we've got a gun control debate. Imagine if everybody had superpowers without any sort of... Well, I mean, that was a facetious comment, but it's not really that if what Ira is talking about, that you can go in and just get extra strength or extra night vision and extra tolerance to cold and extra resistance to radiation. All of that is great. And I hate to even bring up the word of it needs to be regulated and stuff. But John knows this, Ira, that one of my favorite couple of word phrases is, but something went wrong. When I'm hearing all of this stuff, I'm listening to the optimism and all the wonderful stuff it could do. But then the sort of paranoid part of my brain just goes, oh, what could possibly go wrong with that? And as my job as a writer is to figure out how things can get screwed up, because as humans, we tend to be very good at screwing things up that looked like a good thing to start out with.
Yeah, and the reverse of that, though, is that when you think about we've taken things in the opposite direction. So I have some faith in humanity, in the sense, you know, the most poisonous substance this planet ever made, botulinum toxin, is now, you know, a multi-billion-dollar product being injected into, you know, how many people for wrinkles and migraines and every other thing under the sun, not to mention things like ricin and mustard gas and so forth. Everything goes full circle, I think. And yeah, I mean, you make an important point, especially as it comes to sort of these thought experiments. But I guess I have positive thinking towards my fellow man, that we won't find an acceptable balance.
So, and I want to come back to what Kevin said, but I want to come back to a thing you said just a minute ago. You said that, okay, everybody sort of has this preconception for medication and medicine in the, you know, current century is a little white pill that I take every day. 30 milligrams is something that'll solve my problem. And you were saying, look, we've got lots of different ways to look at this. And I don't know about you, Kevin, but I kind of wanted him to elaborate on that. What does that mean?
Sure. So I used to work for GlaxoSmithKline, and they recently invested in a program, I think that was something like $75 million or so, called electroceuticals. What's an electroceutical? A drug doesn't do anything. It's a little chemical, but what a drug is actually doing at the end of the day, it's interfering basically at some deeper physical process in your body. It has no knowledge. It has no consciousness. It basically is allowing a certain signal to flow either slower or faster from one point to another. The concept of the electroceutical is, you know, let's get the drug out of the way entirely. Let's not have a chemical involved, but let's have an electrical signal involved that basically can mimic as if the drug is in your body. That is an example of something that looks decidedly different than a little white pill at Rite Aid. Another example would be a lot of these living bioproducts that are being approved by the FDA as in the last couple of years. I don't know if you know or many people in the audience know, but both leeches and maggots are FDA approved currently for the healing of skin ulcers.
Right. They clean out the necrotic flesh and leave the healthy stuff there.
They leave the healthy stuff there, and they also drool. Leech saliva contains dozens of proteins that help to heal. That's another example of something that, you know, it looks different than a drug when you think about what a drug is today. So that was what I was referring to, that we have to really think differently in terms of, you know, what a pharmacotherapeutic intervention will be.
So two questions on that. First, when will they approve the tapeworm as a diet methodology? Because that seems like that's obvious. I don't know why they haven't come up with that. It should be a tapeworm that will only live long enough for you to lose as much weight as you need to and then dies. Anyways, just something for you to work on. I've given that one to you for free.
Helminthic therapy is actually approved, I believe, in the EU for Crohn's, use in Crohn's disease.
Really? My brother has Crohn's very badly. Yeah. And so a tapeworm would help him? Maybe I could find one.
They're studying it. I mean, a friend of mine has ulcerative colitis, and they're looking into it, believe it or not. You know, you put the worm in and it chews up whatever, all sorts of necrotic stuff that you have in there. So, but yeah, I didn't think about the tapeworm for
Other question is, so when you talk about these electrical things, it makes me think of, you know, the promise of nanotech, right? So nanotech has always been talked about as kind of swallowing the, what was the name of that movie, Kevin, the, you know, where you, you know, they take the spaceship and make it real small and you swallow it.
Oh, that was Fantastic Voyage.
Right. There was another one, too. I'm a little younger than you. Martin Short. Sorry,
well,
Kevin.
That was the spoof of Fantastic Voyage. But yeah, it was the same concept.
Right. So is, you know, when you talk about reorganizing, you know, creating these electrical pulses and reorganizing, is that the kind of thing you're talking about? Is it kind of like swallowing some nanotech that takes all of this to happen?
That's a another version of it. That's more... Now, a little more futuristic, but that stuff is, I mean, we think of pills that you swallow nowadays with little cameras in them to study sort of the inside of the GI system and so forth. So I cannot think of that sort of further miniaturization, especially because in the area of nanotech, when it comes to, you know, nanobots and so forth that need to go in and chew up tumors and all that are going, you know, you're going to have to get the miniaturization down right, and also the weaponry, let's say, that those little devices are going to carry around and how they swarm and all that bit. But yeah, I mean, that's one sort of more elaborate and sort of exotic potential use, yes. A simpler one would be, you know, just the typical sort of electrical and magnetic stimulation devices they have nowadays for back pain and wound healing, things of that nature.
But to your weight loss comment with the tapeworms, John, that I think Iris also talking about, that if you can genetically modify, your body is not going to be prone to obesity. And it might be like literally the miracle diet pill that you are genetically not predisposed to putting on any more weight than your body really needs for its optimal physical form. That of course would make a lot of people happy that they don't really have to do a whole lot of work to keep themselves in shape. I'm a little bit resistant to that because I work really hard to keep myself in shape. But of course, it would be I'd be happy to have, like, in springtime after I got all my like winter fat on, that I don't have to work it all off again, that I could just take a pill and it would get
gone. Yeah, but you're going to need that to hibernate like the squirrels and the bears.
You got well, something like, I mean, I guess our genetic predisposition is that if you have more food than your body needs, it likes to go into stack it up as fat molecules so that you'll need it in times of famine and drought, but mm-hmm. we don't necessarily need that anymore. So every bag of Cheetos that we eat just goes into the fat reservoir and we never lose it.
So let's go back to your idea, but something went wrong. So one of the things you said was reversing. So I wrote down reversion, rejuvenation, and regeneration, right? Mm-hmm. So talk to me about reversion. So are you talking about like reversing age? Like, because that one was very interesting. Like all the people that, like, let's say you figure out how to make people at least, you know, somewhat immortal or something. Like all the people that died ahead of time are going to be really upset. It's like finding out the polio cure, you know, later on. But talk to me about that one a little.
Yeah, I mean, we put aging more in the rejuvenation class, but let me talk about reversion for a second so you can, because this is one of the more exciting, well, everything we're doing is pretty exciting, but when you look at the, as I mentioned, the many organisms out there that, do not die of cancer like we do, or you know, shrug it off. They don't utilize the same strategy in terms of directing a kill event at a tumor. They change the tumor. They basically turn it back into normal tissue. And this is something that has been known since the 1930s when we first started sort of testing carcinogens out, that, you know, you would give a tank full of salamander, some nasty carcinogen, and they develop tumors. And then 2 weeks later, they'd be cancer free. And what we're beginning to realize now when we're going back to these experiments is exactly that. No one's playing with the experiment. Basically, there's this amazing skill in the regenerative process to basically turn back time in a cell and revert it to an earlier state before it was genetically damaged. We don't always only see this in regenerative organisms. This phenomena also exists in embryos. And here in Philadelphia back in the 70s, it was first discovered that you could pump a mammalian embryo full of all sorts of nasty cancer cells. And when the baby was born at the end of the day, it didn't have cancer. And so we've known about this reversion capability in regenerative microenvironments for decades. We've never really done anything with it. So what we are talking about when we talk about reversion in the company is basically that, how we utilize the same sort of signals involved in a regenerative and remodeling response, but do it in more pathologic states like cancer. And basically, instead of focusing on chemotherapy or a smart drug to try to shoot away and kill the tumor and yielding all sort of the negative downstream effects, change the tumor, in essence, back into what it was, normal colon tissue, normal lung tissue, normal breast tissue, whatever. So that is the concept that we're working on here. Nature has designed some very good ways to control oncogenesis, and we need to sort of follow them in 21st century sort of war on cancer too, or else we're going to run into the same problems we have for the last 50 years.
Now, I've been reading some of your other background and some of the fascinating stuff that you're doing. And obviously, it would be great if tomorrow you would release this magic genetic cure that we could all make our bodies superhuman and cancer-free and go back to our optimal 25-year-old bodies. But since that's probably not happening for at least a month or two, in the meantime, you seem to have a lot of good solid thinking on what we ourselves can be doing right now to keep ourselves healthy. And what are some of the, like, the really bad habits that we do that we shouldn't be doing? And what are some of the easy preventive things that we can be doing that we're not? And not, like, not the obvious, don't eat fried food and exercise, anything, and do exercise. But is there some things that you've come up with that could help us become, if not superhuman, at least optimal human by changing a few things in our lifestyle?
Yeah, I mean, and these are pretty basic, but, you know, nonetheless, I like to follow them. A key one is living. So live, eat, drink, whatever, based on our evolutionary place on this planet. Everything on this planet, everything that kills us basically benefited some other species before us. We are not, you know, we're not mountain lions. We do not need high blood sugar levels to go after a prey like some species do. We are not, you know, snakes. We don't need large amounts of inflammation to kill germs because that is their only form of immune response. So, you know, drinking five Cokes and eating, you know, four packs of Twinkies, these are obvious things that are wrong and you shouldn't do them.
Good.
What'd you say again? Five Cokes and Twinkies? Kevin, did you hear that? That's crazy.
Well, as long as they're Diet Coke, it's fine.
Oh. Well, I don't know. Warren Buffett was on the other, you know, a couple of months ago talking about how he drinks five Cokes a day. So I was trying to, I'm a little smarter than him.
Yeah, well, and I drink tons of coffee a day as well. And the thing is, the human genetics, we're all over the place. So you've got one person who will have one cigarette when he's 20 years old and get lung cancer in 5 years and die. And then you got somebody else that smokes five packs a day and she'll live until she's 99 years old. So we have different parameters, but I see one of the things you recommend is to eat lots of spices. What's up with that?
Well, there are just basic natural products that we have, everyone has in their kitchen right now that have pharmacologic effects as good, if not better, than existing drugs. And if you can use them, if you can incorporate them in your diet, whether that's things like cinnamon for blood sugar or turmeric for inflammation, there are these, you know, there's a lot of these areas in terms of sort of herbal and alternative medicine that people sort of throw away on the side and think, oh, but there's a tremendous amount of peer-reviewed literature, and a lot of it just doesn't see the light of day, unfortunately. But it's out there. And if you spend a few hours in something like PubMed at the NIH, you begin to realize, hey, you know, there's 250 published studies here on the benefits of cinnamon. Maybe you should put a little bit more in your diet. And so I'm not a huge natural person, but I like to incorporate natural products because evolutionarily they were placed on this planet with us over billions of years for a purpose. And so I like to incorporate them more than I do synthetic sort of single magic bullet things.
Well, and I occasionally get a sore and swollen toe from gout, and I have to take lots of turmeric and lots of tart cherry juice and stuff. And that seems to work as well as the supposed pharmaceutical stuff.
So I'm trying to picture the labs at BioQuark. So talk to me a little bit about, you know, day in the life at BioQuark.
Yeah, so we have rather, you know, modest laboratory facilities. They're not, you know, Pfizer by any means, but, you know, you come, you will see, I joke around, in many ways, it's like a small petting zoo. You will see frogs, you will see salamanders, you will see various types of fish, like zebra fish, which, you know, whose, you know, brains you can chop out only to regenerate. And then we have the people on the other side, the organisms on the other side of the fence, the mammals. We have mice, rat, rabbit. We had some cat experiments. And basically, you know, there's a two sides to a evolutionary picture where, you know, the folks on one side have skills, have superhuman capabilities that the other folks don't. But basically, our research is focusing on isolating the substances and moieties that are so useful for that salamander regeneration, and then undertaking models, spinal cord injury models, traumatic brain injury models in the mammals, giving them the regenerative capability that they don't normally have. So that is, in essence, the, you know, what you see. We actually had some baby sharks and shark embryos for studying the whole tooth regeneration thing as well.
So the dream is, I'm a soldier. I come back. You know, my dad used to work at Womack out in Fort Bragg. Just so many poor people would come back from the war, and they would live because our medicine has gotten better to where they don't die on the side of the road from an IED or something. But of course, we just have lots of amputees, and so they come back just. Talk to me, like, I'm still trying to understand, like, what's that look like? Like, do you, you know, do you start working with them with a therapy, and in a year or 2 years they grow back a leg, or do they grow back one tonight? And how quickly can they use it? Is it as good as the last one? And also, just as a side thought, you know, what about PTSD and things like that?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. Yeah, so we're separating the two for a minute. PTSD and sort of trauma to the central nervous system, that's a much easier approach than limb regeneration right now, because that's a single target, a single tissue that's easy to administer a current pharmaceutical to. But yeah, so any injury that causes damage, destruction, death of the tissue will be a target of ours. So, you know, whether that's 3 months of therapy or 6 months of therapy, over time, we are rebuilding and remodeling that specific part of the brain, let's say, to recover its full structure and function. You know, part of this is the cellular growth and regeneration, but other parts of it, and this is in some ways even more important, is the signaling apparatus that says, you know, a part of the brain goes here, you know, don't build eyeballs or a heart inside the skull, because, you know, this is a problem with stem cells. You know, stem cells can become anything, so we want to avoid those problems, and that's been a key part of the program. So whether we're talking about damage to the central nervous system or sort of a pathological situation like they may experience with PTSD, where the neurons are not destroyed, but they have been changed. They've been tolerated to the catastrophic fear and the trauma that they observed in the war zone. In both cases, we're dealing with the same type of therapeutics. We basically want to revert or erase the damage that's been done to those cells and then create healthy cell growth and morphogenic structure. Basically create the new part of the brain, the new part of the spinal cord. The limb is a little bigger project. We're not there yet. This is going to require not just the biologic stimulation that says, you know, there's new growth here, but also various scaffolding for new tissue to model onto. So we are still a bit away from, you know, being able to regrow an entire limb. But the path is, in essence, the same. So there's, you know, the three parts of it, basically how you stimulate new growth, how you get rid of necrotic tissue, how you get rid of scar tissue, which blocks new growth, and then ultimately how, in the case of a limb, how you regenerate integrated structures, because there you have musculature, you have bone, you have nerves, you have vasculature. It's a much bigger, more integrated and complex system than just a single tissue.
So real quick on that, this is fascinating. Could that be something that could lean to help with Alzheimer's?
Yeah. And it's interesting enough because we spend a lot of time in the lab on traumatic brain injury. And one of the fascinating things with traumatic brain injury is that you have the same inflammatory biomarkers that you see turned on in Alzheimer's disease, nitric oxide and COX and beta amyloid precursor proteins and so forth. They become hyperregulated when you have traumatic brain injury. Why? Because they are also in many ways neuroprotective in the short term. So yes, whether we're talking about the brain injury in acute sense or Alzheimer's disease, dementia, Parkinson's, and everything that is more of a chronic degenerative disease, the same underlying reversion of pathology is what we're targeting. There is no, unlike a drug company that's developing a specific drug just for some output of Alzheimer's disease as they do nowadays, where you could not interchangeably use the therapeutic. In our case, it's sort of a universal platform. We don't care if it's Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, or brain injury, the same remodeling effect is what we're looking for.
Well, I want to bring up something because I've been in my own publishing house and working together. We're doing a book with Ray Kurzweil, who is very well known. Developer of AI and is very much a proponent of basically the human immortality project. And what he's really trying to do is develop a way to copy every thought and every memory that's in our brain and put it into an artificial intelligence so that everything that we are gets stored, every memory we have. And of course, that would be better than real humans, because I don't remember half of the things I did last week. So that would be better. And what you're talking about is not more of a mechanical computer artificial pumping up of memories. You're talking about refreshing and restoring our original superhero suit that we have, the human body.
Yeah, I mean, in the world of sort of transhumanism per se, there's two factions. One, which sort of where I hang out, which is in the carbon side of things, and then the sort of the silicon. I'm not very interested in being a cyborg anytime soon or uploading myself into a computer. I like sort of my carbon shell. Uh-huh. I like anything that can be replaced. I prefer. And the smart people tell you, sort of in the organ transplant world, you know, you don't really need a new organ until you lose a substantial part of the existing one. And if we can regenerate and repair the one you have as you're going downhill so that you never need a transplant of some type, great. I mean, we think that's probably a more, at least for our carbon interests more in the direction that we want to go. The issue I have with sort of mind uploading in general, and this interestingly goes sort of back to the regenerative biology era, is sort of all of the unexplainable phenomena that the, you know, the sort of the connectome-centric model of the human mind, that, you know, we are nothing more than this, the few pounds of stuff inside the skull, do not explain. And one of these is the basic knowledge that's existed since the 50s that all of the regenerative organisms whose brains you can destroy entirely and have them grow back somehow retain memory.
Yeah, they remember stuff.
Planarians, amphibians, even metamorphic insects who lose 90% of their brain mass remember things. On top of that, you have the sort of the wide range of like human phenomena from things like terminal lucidity and Alzheimer's patients to gain in function after destruction in terms of, you know, savant syndrome, or even, you know, these weird cases of kids that, you know stuff that they never learned before, like down at University of Virginia Perceptual Studies Center, you know, three-year-olds that know everything about World War I fighter pilots and all this business, none of which is explainable by the connectome-centric model of the mind. So while I think, you know, Kurzweil's stuff is neat and, you know, if he can do it, great, I just question how much is inside the skull.
Well, can you fill us in on the what you just talked about, the three-year-olds knowing about World War One? I haven't heard about that. That sounds like almost like a genetic memory kind of thing, like back to the Dune and everything that I've been writing in the Dune universe.
That's how they try to explain it. That's the most popular case. There was a book written on that one several years ago. But there's many. I mean, there's 2,500 cases they have down there that have been documented. So it's not sort of this weird one-time occurrence. The other issue is, you know, as mentioned before, the gain in function stuff, Rain Man and induced savant syndrome, where you have, you know, the ability to do something like play Mozart one day, even though you never had a piano lesson in your life. This stuff is also quite well documented. Genetic memory is one of the ways they try to explain it. I mean, it's one theory. The other thing is, and this is really fascinating, if you go to places like Mike Levin's lab up at Tufts University, where they're studying non-central nervous system information processing and storage, which has sort of been unheard of, but, you know, there's plenty of organisms on this planet that do not have brains. Brains came very late in sort of the evolutionary scheme of things. And there's many organisms out there that process electrochemical and electromagnetic information without brains, without neurons. We do in our heart, in our bones, in our pancreas. It's even been demonstrated that schools of sperm swimming together looking for an egg are communicating between one another. No neurology involved here. And keep in mind that you and I and everyone, we did not have brains for the first several weeks of our existence, yet accomplished a tremendous amount. So whether it's genetic memory, whether it is non-central nervous system memory or some other form that we just do not quite understand yet, the work going on at places like Tufts and RMIT down in Australia on these concepts is truly fascinating, because it really is going to turn upside down in many ways, I think, this whole concept of where the human mind is, and that it's much more than just the skull.
So it's interesting, because what you're saying kind of leads me to this thing. I just looked it up because I didn't know if it was true or not. And Snopes says it's true, but who knows? But you've heard the concept of 21.3 grams.
Sure.
So the idea.
Can you describe it?
Yeah, sure. So the idea that I guess a bunch of doctors like weighed people, and right after they died, for no apparent reason, they weigh somewhere around that 21 or 23 grams, or I can't look at the exact number here, but they weigh exactly this much less, 21 grams less than they weighed, you know, when they were alive. And supposedly no one can explain it, although there's, you know, been a lot of changes since then. But a lot of people would say, oh, well, that's the soul leaving
the
body.
Weight of the soul. Okay.
Right, right. So is it that maybe these other planariums, I think is what you called them, that are capable of regenerating from complete destruction, like Wolverine and or Deadpool, are capable of sort of, you know, not losing whatever that is that keeps things together?
It could be a version of that. It's either going elsewhere, and not to get too esoteric, but it's either elsewhere. And when I say elsewhere, it could be elsewhere in the the neural component of their being, whether that is in gap junctions or subnuclear components of cell, whatever, or it's really elsewhere in terms of extra dimensional space or space time, whatever. I'm not a not a quantum physics guy. I don't want to talk beyond this, but let's say just going back to the comic books for a second, it is a la the Silver Surfer's Power Cosmic. It is beyond sort of probably sort of our current understanding at this point in time, and we will have to violate some of the rules to study it.
So there you go, Kevin.
Wow, that's fascinating.
I know, my head's spinning. I know about yours. I totally got to go research more of this now.
I mean, this has been full of really cool ideas that I can think of lots of ways for it to go wrong and write stories about it. But that's what my profession is. So we've got, we're kind of wrapping up in the next couple of minutes. But Ira, why don't you give us a little bit of rundown of what are we expecting from BioQuark? Are you primarily research? Or are you looking to come up with some kind of a product or process that you can be looking for investors on, or that you're going to bring to market so that we can become superhumans? Or is this really just base level research that you're working on right now?
No. We have a so we're a US based company. We have a 3-year plan to be in the clinic for an organ regeneration indication here in the United States. So we're 3 years out from the clinic here, but that entails a drug development program of a so-called orphan fast track condition. But at the same time, we are actively developing partnerships in other countries, because this is a fairly integrated research system nowadays. We're active in Southeast Asia right now, Middle East, a little bit in Latin America, where we are speeding up the clinical development process on all fronts. So we foresee ourselves developing as an integrated pharmaceutical company. Simultaneously, we are also in the consumer healthcare business. We have some partners that are sort of beginning to leverage some of what we're doing in regeneration for consumers' health and skincare. But yeah, so that is in essence the path that we are taking. We are far beyond basic research at this point, and we're completely open to the fact that a lot of what we've done is not original. It comes, as I mentioned, from decades of things before that just from a translational perspective never jumped across the valley and always maintained sort of history and papers in the petri dish. We wanted to take it to the next levels.
You know what I love about this, Kevin? I love that this is totally doing good for the world. Uh-huh. It's all the optimism and if you just took one of these things, just Alzheimer's is such a hideous and horrible and torturous thing. And it would just be amazing if that was something like polio that was a thing of the past. So I just applaud you for that, Ira, and your optimism and this. Real quick. So bioquark.com, that's BioQuark, and we'll have this on the website as part of the rundown. Is there any other place, a Twitter feed or YouTube or anything else where you post stuff or things that people should go look at?
If you will Google our name, you'll find a Facebook and a LinkedIn page, things like that. We have a Twitter. And in general, come to the website because it links to everywhere, and it basically talks about not just what we're doing in the lab, but sort of the partnerships. And we're an open book. We're very passionate about this area specifically because I come out of the pharmaceutical industry and I sort of know the past and I know sort of where we could be if we had done things a little different the last 20, 30 years. And I want to get this done. I believe that there is a very promising future in terms of sort of our biologic future. And I do not, I think too often people look at this whole space and they're like, it's always 50 years away, or it's, evil company that's doing it. There's good stuff happening here.
That's awesome.
I just really like to get the message out.
Well, thank you.
And the website has some other links to other articles and things to look at. So much more than what we could talk about here just briefly. But this is totally fascinating. This, my brain's spinning and excited about, people have said over and over again that we are living in the most exciting time in the history of the human race. And I think you're kind of reaffirming that.
I think so, too. I think definitely that's where we are. And if we don't make the mistakes of the last part of the 20th century, We really think outside the box. We're going to do some transformational stuff.
Thank you so much for joining us, Ira. We appreciate it. I hope you'll come back and give us an update sometime in the future.
Absolutely.
And folks who are listening, thanks for hanging in with us.
Yeah. Thanks, everybody. We appreciate you listening, and listen to us at our next podcast. This is Kevin J. Anderson signing off.
John Best signing out, because I don't sign off. That's it.
All right.
Thanks, everyone.
One way or the other. We'll talk to you next time.
You've been listening to Creative Futurism with Kevin J. Anderson and John Best. For more information, go to creativefuturism.com. Thank you.